Right. So, first off, we seem to have a problem with the assignment 3 links. They did work. I know the department's been doing some stuff on their server. So, I'll get that fixed, hopefully, at the break. And we'll get that working again. All right. So, there's that. We'll have your second assignment back for you at the end of class as well. Okay. We have no screen. Hold on. We can fix that. There we go. We were on to issues here with outcome characteristics at the end of last class. So we said it's a nonlinear effect. If you make your reinforcer or punisher larger, you're generally going to get a stronger effect up until some point, and then it starts to drop off. But you also have to remember that there are actually what we're going to call qualitative differences between different types of reinforcers and punishers. Some of this depends upon the species. Foot shock is a particularly good punisher with things like rats and mice. It is a terrible punisher for things like pigeons or reptiles. Having scaly feet, they just don't really feel the shock very much. To make shock an effective punisher for something like an iguana, you've basically got to turn it up so much that you've got cooked iguana. So that's punishing in the sense they'll never do the behavior again, but they won't do anything else again either. So not terribly effective there. So these do make differences in terms of things. So again, we've talked about this, going back to why do we use the same kind of basic species over and over and over in comparative psych, pigeons and rats and mice, oh my. Well, it's because we've got a lot of experience with just exactly what are going to be good reinforcers or punishers. Like I've said, most rats really like chocolate. I don't know if a warthog likes chocolate. Would I love to do a conditioning study with warthogs? Probably not. But still, I mean, if I did, I'd have to find out what is a really good reinforcer for warthog behavior. I just don't know. Got to run that study first. Now keep in mind as well, there's also going to be, besides species differences, individual differences. I just said this. Most rats really like chocolate. There's always the odd one that doesn't. So if you just happen to have, you know, a few rats that don't like chocolate, oh, my reinforcer isn't working. They're not, well, you may give them the chocolate as a reinforcer, and it may be that it's just not an effective reinforcer, but you may conclude erroneously they can't learn this task. It may simply be that they don't like the chocolate, they're not reinforced for it, they're not motivated to perform. So these become significant issues. Now, when you get into dealing with people, this is even more complicated, right? I mean, you know, if you've got someone who's diabetic, giving them sugary things is probably not good, not ideal. There may just simply be preferences. We're going to talk about this in a while. We're going to be talking about it's called Premax principle. But different individuals have different preferences for different things. So very important to keep this in mind. For anybody that's thinking of doing any sort of psychology work with humans, important. Last one I just want to mention here is specifically with respect to punishment. And it's the issue of tolerance. We talked about tolerance before in terms of the effects of drugs. But we see this with punishers as well. If you start with a low-strength punisher, something that is a not terribly aversive outcome, subjects can develop tolerance to that. They will gradually, they won't have much effect. And so what you'll have to do is you'll have to increase the aversiveness of the outcome to try to suppress the behavior, tolerance for that, and so on and so on. Eventually, you're having to deliver extremely highly aversive outcomes, which may be doing all kinds of other damage to your subject. It is better to start with punishment by using a more intense punisher, a more highly aversive one. And then you can actually reduce it. So remember my example with my friend's little dogs, right? Grab the dog immediately, pin it down by the throat, growl at it. One thing, it's a species-specific thing. The dog's little brain gets that. But this was pretty intense for the dog. Toss it in the kennel, leave it. fine. As opposed to, bad dog. It's like, oh no, I've been told I was bad, but nothing else happened. Ooh, I'm going to go eat something else or poop on something. Okay. So if you start with something more intense, you can then reduce this. After a few times of this, I just have to point at the dog and kind of glare at it, and we were good. There's a risk to this, of course. How intense is too intense, right? That is why in therapeutic situations, don't start using aversives unless you've got some background and training in what the appropriate level is going to be, okay? Because you can do damage. So for the layperson, probably better to work with reinforcers there. Task. We call these task characteristics. Some tasks are just simpler to learn than others. Again, species and individual differences. It is easier to train a mouse to hop on a little running wheel and run to avoid a shock or to terminate a shock. Than it is to train something like, a Kodiak bear to do that. I mean, think about this. Species-specific defense reactions. What's a species-specific defense reaction for a mouse? Well, a popular one is running away. Okay, they're predisposed to do that. Very easy for the mouse to make that connection. Wait, if I just hop in this wheel and run, I stop getting shocked? Oh, sweet, I can do that. Or, I mean, I don't think anyone's actually done this with a bear, you know. So, here's your cattle prod, and here's your will. We want you to go up and shock the bear. Let's see what happens. Yeah, okay, so we'll do this. But, I mean, hypothetically here, Kodiak bear, one of the largest bears we got, is not likely to run away from very much. I mean, they tear smaller bears apart kind of for kicks. So, going to be harder to teach. On the flip side, it's probably a lot easier to condition a bear to rear up on its hind legs as opposed to in response to an aversive outcome than it is to train a mouse to do this, right? What happens when a mouse rears up on its hind legs? Look, my soft little furry tummy, go ahead, eat me, he says to the cat. Right. That's not good. Mice tend to hunker down if they have to. They don't freeze standing up. They freeze down into a crouched position. Okay, so species differences. And similarly, individual differences. Okay, I've been an instructor long enough to know some people just get this stuff more easily than others. Some of that's innate predispositions. A lot of it is probably past conditioning, past learning. Frequently get a lot of art students that say, math. Ugh. It's okay. Honestly, most of the math is not difficult. If you can, survive in the basic day-to-day world in Canada, that's the kind of level of math we're doing here. But there's a predisposition here as well, right? You know, drawn to the arts, maybe just think, maybe you've been exposed to this idea that any sort of math is horrible or terrible, or you just don't like it, whatever it is. Okay, so again, individual and species differences could be due to genetics, could be due to previous learning. This is another reason why we often like to work with what we call naive subjects if we're working with non-humans, right? Because then they haven't been exposed to any particular learning situations. If you're the first one to, you know, if you got a seven-week-old rat and you're the first one to do a conditioning study with it, great. It has no prior specific conditioning besides, you know, growing up in a little rat habitat or something like that. Okay. Deprivation levels. When we use things like primary reinforcers for non-humans, so rats or pigeons or gerbils or mice or dogs or whatever, we tend to put them at what we call a reduced weight So we reduce what we say we reduce them below their free feeding weight. What does that mean? Well, when, for example, rats, let's talk about rats because I've done this with rats. You take a baseline measure for a week or two. You measure the you weigh the rat every day, and you see what its weight is. And you get sort of the average there over a week or two. Now, when you're doing this, what typically happens with rats is just when they're housed, they're in their little boxes, housed individually, and the person that's taking care of them comes in, puts a big handful of rat chow on the top of their cage at the beginning of the day, always make sure the water bottle is filled up, and the rat, having not much else to do, sits there and just keeps pulling little bits of rat chow through the bars and eating them, right? It's like the ultimate couch potato. So you can get some pretty hefty rats at this point. You know, it's like, whoa, 2 kilos of rat here. That's a lot of rat, all right? And it's not a rat in trim fighting form, let's just say. So we got kind of these roly-poly rats. And that's their free feeding weight. Much like people, if there's nothing else to do, we tend to, well, generally eat if we can. So what we do is we put them on a little bit of a diet, often down to, say, maybe 80% of their free feeding weight. So what happens is now, instead of just putting enough food in there for the rat to, like, never run out throughout the day, we may only make the food available for 1 hour. Okay? And the point of this is to restrict their access to food. We keep weighing them. Okay, if they're still not losing weight, you only having access to food for 1 hour, you may say, oh, okay, we're only going to give you 4 pieces of food. Okay, so you got to play with this. But what you do then is, over a period of a few weeks, you drop the animal down to 80% or so, maybe 90%, maybe 75%, you know, whatever, usually about 80% of their free feeding weight. You're starving the rat. No, we're not starving the rat. We're just making the rat less fat. Okay, same for the pigeon. Okay, so remember, this free feeding weight is like you got a Barca lounger with a fridge underneath it, and you can just keep pulling stuff out and eating it all day while watching TV or movies. That's the rat's existence, okay, up to this point. So we're taking it down. So it's a little bit hungry compared to where it was before, but it's not starving. What this does is provide motivation to actually perform a task for a, say, food reinforcer. You could do it with water. You could deprive access to water for a while so they're feeling a bit thirsty, so perform for a fluid, for a liquid. Okay, so this is the idea. Now, if we don't do this, say a food reinforcer, a primary reinforcer, not terribly effective. We're not going to get, it's not going to be a good reinforcer. The animal is essentially satiated coming into the task. They're already pretty full. Another problem we can get into is with what's actually called reinforcer satiation. That's when you give so many reinforcers, like little bits of food, that the animal actually just fills up. And so you might have a very reinforcing piece of, you know, bits of food there, but at some point, if you, the rat's eaten too much of it, it gets full. And so you'll see performance start to drop off, all right, because the reinforcer is no longer adequate, right? An interesting thing that can happen is when we deprive animals, non-human animals and humans as well, this deprivation can motivate behavior that will result in a punishing outcome. So imagine you've got someone who is starving, and so they steal a loaf of bread. Now, by stealing a loaf of bread, they end up getting caught and sent to jail. But if you're starving, what's worse, starving to death or spending a few nights in jail? Matter of fact, in our society, at least if you're in jail, they'll feed you. And in fact, we do see this. People that work with individuals that have been sent into the penal system know that for some people that are have very little, that are out on the streets, they'll actually do some crime, not because, you know, they're quote-unquote bad, but someone will suddenly take care of them. They'll get put in jail. They'll be fed. They'll have a warm place to sleep. It's not that bad. I mean, in some countries, it's a horrible idea of things to do because jails are not good. But here in Canada, it's not the worst place to be. Right? So, if you, again, ever get into a situation whether you're dealing with children or you're going to teaching or whatnot, and you're going, why are these kids, why are they misbehaving? Worse for adults as well. Why are these adults misbehaving? Why are they doing something? They know they're going to get in trouble. It's like, okay, well, gets back to what we talked about before. Maybe this is the only way they can get attention. Maybe there's something else going on here. So take a look at the situation. See if maybe there's a case of deprivation. If there is, that case of deprivation could be providing the motivation to engage in some behavior that otherwise will result in what you might think of as an aversive. As long as the aversive is of a lower intensity than whatever's causing the deprivation, you'll keep getting that undesired behavior. Okay? So this becomes an important one for consideration, especially if you're working in an applied or therapeutic field of psychology. Right? So related to this, you got to ask, if you've got undesired behaviors occurring, you've got behaviors that, however it's been set up, this behavior will result in an aversive outcome, and the subject is still doing it, you've got to say why. Remember, let's go back to our basic definitions. A reinforcer is something that increases a behavior or maintains it at a higher level. A punisher is something that decreases a behavior or keeps it suppressed if it's already at a low level. If you've got some behavior being performed that will lead to a, we think, aversive outcome, and yet it's still being done, there is something reinforcing. There is some reinforcer that is motivating this. Anyone been on the long car trip with the family, right? Kids in the back seat, you know. Mom! Elliot poked me! Stop poking. Mom! Grayson threw her sandwich at me! Right? You know. At some point, the father's just like, look, if you kids don't settle down, I'm going to drive this car off the first cliff I come to. Okay. So you've got that going on. It's like, oh, fear of death. Okay. Maybe, you know, let's assume that the father will actually do this. And still, it's like, pulled my hair. Over the edge. Okay. So you still got this happening. Why? Well, maybe let's hypothesize here. The kids are really bored in the back seat of, you know, your Ford Flex, and because you didn't go for the extra package that has the drop-down, you know, DVD players or something like that. And so, you're driving to Regina, and hey, lovely city, but getting there. You done the drive? I mean, it's flat. Okay. So, for young kids, it's not the most exciting thing in the world to do. So what's more exciting? Looking out the window at, oop, saw some hay, cow, or poke your sibling, get a response. Okay, they know they're going to get in some sort of trouble from the parents, but that trouble is probably, here's another thing, that aversive outcome is probably delayed. What are the parents really going to do? Are they just literally going to slam on the brakes in the middle of the highway, you know, fishtail, have cars going around you into the ditch so they can get out and deliver some punisher? It's like, oh, the next rest stop we're at, you know, like 3 hours from now. It's like, duh, then you're going to get it. Remember we talked about this delay? So the delayed aversive, it's like way in the future, by which point the parents may forget. They may just be happy to be able to get out of the car themselves. Who knows? And so, you know, the immediate get a reaction out of my sibling, way more reinforcing than potential aversive outcome. Okay, so you got to keep these in mind, right? Whenever you're dealing with, you know, any sort of situation where you've got individuals engaging in these undesired behaviors, especially if they know what the outcome, they know there's going to be an aversive outcome. You know, say, okay, what's going on? There's got to be something that's providing, all other things being equal, there is something in there that is providing some form of reinforcement. Okay? Now, this is leaving aside a few very specific psychological problems where individuals just can't, even distinguish or seem to recognize the consequences of their actions. But for most people, you got to sort of break that. You don't just say, you know, bad kids or bad seed or whatever, you know, bad dog. It's like, no, what's going on? There's something else probably happening. I had a friend who's, she got a new boyfriend, and her dog, she was a dog for years, just started peeing on her bed. That was it. So really annoying when you get into bed and it's like soggy with dog urine. Yeah, not pleasant, not pleasant. Okay, but it's like, oh, she suddenly became a bad dog. And it's like, no, she's probably not suddenly become a bad dog. But she was always a bad dog. No, it's not. It's like, what did you do? You just changed. You brought this guy into the house, right? You're no longer spending all your time with your dog. Okay, the dog knows she's not supposed to pee on things. She's been housebroken for years. The dog knows that's a bad thing to do. Gets that, knows that her person is going to be upset. But at least now the person has to, you know, my friend has to deal with the dog. There's the attention, okay? So this applies to non-humans as well. Cats, a little bit different. Cats just, you know, they're sort of like psychopaths. They'll just, like, poke the bear because they're bored. It's like, I don't know, I think I will claw up this couch. I know they will hate it. Yeah. Ever since the whole Puss in Boots thing, I think that all cats have a Spanish accent. It's so much more amusing that way. Anyways, so one of the things you can do then is, you got a problem here, find an alternative source of reinforcement. So the kids are bored in the back seat of the car, pull into the first dealership and get the DVD players put it. No, you know, find something else. Do a little game with them. It's like, okay, 10 points for the first person that can spot a, whatever, Montana license plate in a car driving past us. What's that look like? Well, keep looking. Maybe you'll see one. I can't read. Well, good time to learn. Find something that's actually going to be entertaining. So let them do something else that they can get that reinforcement from in a way that's not going to be leading to an aversive outcome. We'll come back to talking about that in a little while. Okay. I don't think this is actually, I'm sure if this is in your textbook or not, but we'll talk about it here. Latent learning. And I've already actually sort of touched on this in a couple of contexts already, but there's a difference between issues of learning a behavior and actually performing the behavior. So here's the thing. Let's say I take the whole class and say, yes, I've just gotten this grant from whatever, Windows, to do a study to see how well people do with learning the new operating system. So this half, we're going to bring somebody in who's going to train you on things. This half of the class, if you perform well in a test afterwards on the Windows system, we'll give you $50. This side of the class, if you perform well on a test on the Windows operating system, we'll say thank you very much. How is that? It's just the way it is, right? You know? Experimental control groups, yada, yada. Okay, so we do the test, and what do we find? This side of the class does pretty well. This side of the class, most of the people don't. Now, what can we conclude from that? Either this side of the class is really smart and good at computers, and that side of the class is just stupid as rocks. Or did you perhaps both learn equally? But you guys have got a $50 motivation, and you guys got basically nothing. Sorry, next time I do this, I'll swap the sides of the class for the imaginary money that nobody's really getting. Okay, I see a few people are just like, why do I get $50? This is the reason I have $50, all right? That was clear. Anyways, If we measure learning by performance, then if there's a lack of motivation, you're just not going to perform. So our inference that you have learned something based upon performance may not be correct. You may have learned something, but without the motivation to actually perform, you're not going to demonstrate it. Okay, so latent learning is an important concept. We see it a lot with humans. We see it with non-humans as well. Study done by Tolman and Hanzig back in 1950. They ran rats through mazes, so they recorded the average number of errors here from this first group. Now, this first group of rats here, go through the maze and no food at the end. So the rat would be taken out of its cage, put in the maze, blah, 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 blah. Wander around, we'll get to the end, get taken out, but back in the home cage. And if we take a look at their performance here, they suck. Right? I mean, there's a small drop in average errors over the course of the study, but they do not do well at all. Let's contrast this with a second group that is given a desired food treat at the end of the maze. These rats learn very quickly. They do very well. Very few errors after a few days of tests, or a few days of training, excuse me. Third group. Third group of rats receives no food at the end of the maze for the first 10 days. On the 11th day, they get to the end of the maze, and there's some of this yummy rat food waiting for them. Now, here's what happens in the next few days. They get really smart and learn in one day. Or maybe they've learned the maze just as well as our food group over the first 10 days, but until there's some reason for them to hustle their little rat bums down to the end of the maze, that is, until there's some yummy food waiting for them, they're not motivated to perform. That's the idea of latent learning. So the most parsimonious explanation for our third group of rats here is that they were learning the layout of the maze over the first 10 days, but they didn't have any particular reason to hurry through. Matter of fact, actually, given that most of the time the rats spend inside the little home cages, this might be like the most fun they're having all day. It's like, oh, I get to get out, stretch my legs, wander around, sniff something new. Yeah, okay, this is great. Yeah. I'm in no hurry. As soon as I get to the end, I get put back in my cage. But suddenly there's food there. It's like, oh, yeah, I want to get that. Off they go. All right? So this is the idea. Performance and actual learning are different. You can learn without a reinforcer, but you are less likely to perform without an appropriate reinforcer. Okay? So learning can occur, but if we don't actually provide the motivation, performance may be low. If you got a class that you don't that's not really that important to your degree, you don't really care about that much, if you can get by with your other grades, maybe you learn the stuff, but you don't really work it on the exam. You don't put everything you can into your final paper. You don't worry too much if you're a bit late on an assignment. If you've got a really important course, though, you need this. This is the make or break course. More effort's going into that. Okay? Probably won't make as many little simple goofs, right? So, latent learning. People that work in human resources, this becomes a big issue for human resources, right? You got a workforce that's just not doing well, or they've got a high level of, say, on-site job accidents, injuries. Guys, poorly trained, bad workforce, whatever it is. It's like, yeah, or maybe the workforce just doesn't have the motivation to actually perform well. A variety of studies have shown this. By providing appropriate, desired reinforcers for, say, on-site safety, accident rates drop. If you set it up such that, you know, for every 7 days, you can go on the factory floor with no injuries, there will be whatever, bonus to the weekly salary or whatever it is. What you start seeing is the individual workers start helping policing one another. It's like, whoa, Joe, look out for that. It's like, oh, yeah, okay, good. They avoid an injury. Okay? Suddenly there's motivation to actually perform better. So very important concept here. All right. Extinction. We've talked about extinction a little bit. So extinction occurs when our response no longer produces the expected outcome, the same outcome. So this is slightly different from in classical conditioning. There, the CS no longer leads to the same US event. But in the case of operant conditioning, in the presence of the discriminative stimulus, the response no longer produces this outcome. So that's when we get into extinction. And what will happen is the response will drop off. Okay? Subject will stop making that response in the presence of the discriminative stimulus. Now, one of the things that we can often get into is what is called an extinction burst. Doesn't always happen, but this is not uncommon. If suddenly, you know, when you first put a subject onto extinction, you've probably all seen one of these. Ever been in a store and seen a kid, you know, like a toy aisle or something, seen a kid have a temper tantrum, or I think they call them hissy fits now. You know, the terminology may have shifted from when I was a kid. Temper tantrum. Okay, let's go with that. That's essentially extinction burst. Now, we don't know always why that has happened, but, you know, we can imagine a case where perhaps, hypothetically, we've had a kid that is, you know, the gimme kid. Give me this. And it's like, okay, have that. Give me this, have that. And then if someone suddenly says no, kaboom. Gimme, 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 gimme. Yell louder. If you didn't get it by saying it once, say it more. That's an extinction burst. If the rat's been pressing the lever to get yummy little chocolate pellets, and suddenly we turn off the lever, so now it doesn't give any more pellets, what happens? It starts pressing the lever really fast, really hard. May even start biting the lever, tacking the lever, smacking the lever around. Okay. You've seen people do this with... actually, have you ever wondered why vending machines? You're probably too young to remember this. Vending machines didn't used to be bolted to the walls. Oh, yeah. When I was young, they were never bolted to the walls. They were just standing there, freestanding vending machines. And it's not because people are really worried about someone stealing a vending machine. If we don't bolt to the wall, someone's going to steal it. I'd be like, what are you going to do, steal, you know, a 600-pound vending machine, just carry it out with you one night? Oh, that way I can get my Hershey's bars whenever I want them. It's like, no, you still have to put the money in, don't you? Now, the reason they did this was because, it was from initially issues on military bases. So you've got military bases, you've got young soldiers being trained to exercises, go out, you know, destroy something, kill something, you know, very aggressive. So they get back to base and, you know, they want their, whatever, Coca-Cola or something, Coke, it's the drink of destruction. Okay, so I put the money in the machine and nothing comes out. Now, being soldiers with a kind of can-do kind of attitude, they've been taught not just to take that. They're going to make that machine give them the drink and, you know, push the button a few more times, punch the button a few more times. Usually, fortunately, the live ammo has been taken away at this point. From the trainees, but you just don't take no, so, you know, some soldiers start rocking this back and forth, try to shake it loose, and then tips over and crushes them. Yes, and that's the kind of sound it makes. Actually, more of a crunch, splat, sound is what it'd be. You don't look particularly good if your military tombstone says crushed by Coca-Cola machine. That's not impressive. So this is where this started from, was from instances on military base, but some have been seen on campuses as well, university campuses. I've never heard of anyone actually being killed by them, on a Canadian campus at least, but there have been injuries. So about 10 years or so, they start just bolting these all to the wall. That's an extinction burst, right? If you're used to put your money in the machine, punch the button, get your snack, then if it doesn't happen, that's very frustrating. Let's just call it frustration. So you try it some more. If that doesn't work, you do something a little more extreme. Okay, so extinction bursts. So the anger, the frustration, these are commonly seen. You might also get a variation in behavior. So if the first technique doesn't work, pushing the button doesn't work, you might try something else. Okay, if a kid gets blocked on give me the toy from one parent, might go and switch and try another parent. Might see whether or not he can, like, you know, smuggle the toy out of the store under his windbreaker or something like that. You might try something else. So the variability of behavior can get in. Can I have another cookie? No, I think you've had enough cookies. Night bulb. I don't need to ask permission. I just have to wait for my parent to leave the room. Then I'll go get all the cookies I want. Yeah. Okay, so variability of behavior. The interesting, those are some issues with first putting subjects onto extinction. So this can be a bit of a problem with moving on to extinction. We'll talk later about ways, some of the things to get around this. That's in our chapter six. But the other thing with this I want to mention is spontaneous recovery. So think back to classical conditioning. After we put the CS onto extinction, we let some time pass, and then we represent the conditional stimulus, we find there is a really small return in the conditional response. We see the same sort of thing with extinction in operant conditioning. So if we've trained up an operant response, and the presence of stimulus make the response get this outcome, we then go through extinction, response no longer produces the outcome, then let some time pass. Now, put the subject back in, present the discriminative stimulus, typically find that we get a bit of that response occurring again. Tries it a few more times. If still there's no outcome, stops. Let some more time pass. Might try again. The vending machine is actually a pretty good analogy for this. Let's imagine that you've had a particular vending machine on campus that you've, you know, gone to through your university career so far. You've always had a good relationship with this vending machine. He or she, if you anthropomorphize it, has treated you well over the time. You feel close to this machine. And then one day you go there, you put the money in, and nothing is being given out. You give and give, and you get nothing back. It's hurtful. So that's the end of your relationship. But the next year, you've gone away for the summer, you come back the next year, and you see your vending machine, your old vending machine there, your ex-vending machine, if you will. And you think, maybe it's time for a fresh start. And so you try again. There's a spontaneous recovery. Okay? Only time will tell whether or not you're going to get reinforcement out of renewing this relationship. Anyhow, that leads us nicely into behavior modification. Trying to change individuals' behavior. We tend to forget it living in a world of access to all kinds of neuropsychotropic drugs. Neuropsychopharmacology has become a very, very big field and a very, very big business. But we tend to forget, if you go back in time, even, say, 40 years, there were very few drugs that had any useful effect on the brain for psychological conditions. This is why, like, when Ritalin came in, this was such a big deal. Yay, we've got something. Well, it's all kinds of problems with Ritalin, but at the time, this seemed like a huge, huge thing. You go back, I mean, opiates. So you could use things like morphines, opiates, barbiturates to try to reduce behaviors by calming people down, but there was all kinds of other consequences to that. You know, addiction was one of them. Generally, overall suppression of behavior, not just the specific problem you were dealing with. So there's very few drugs that were actually useful. Nowadays, it's just like, well, we've got this problem. Let's try to actually make a drug to do this. So you go back into the 1950s, and people like B.F. Skinner and others started developing a field of therapy called behavior analysis, which was the word of the time. But basically, it's behavior modification. So it's trying to adjust, alter, change behaviors using principally operant conditioning techniques, but also some classical conditioning. So you go back, counter conditioning, like back to Mary Coker Jones, also fell within the sort of broad umbrella of behavior modification, but it really sort of got a step forward when we move into the 50s, and there'd been a lot more work being done in things like shaping the operant, in the operant area. Particularly once there had been a bit more learned about differences, similarities, issues with respect to reinforcement and punishment. What make generalized reinforcers, what you have to tailor to an individual, these sorts of things. So the whole field of behavior modification started to come in. And for a number of years, for about 25, 30 years, this was actually one of the principal and perhaps most successful areas of psychological therapy. It's been somewhat displaced now. You do find behavioral therapists still. But as I said, with the advent of so many new pharmaceuticals, it's just a lot cheaper to give someone a pill. But that doesn't necessarily adjust long-term the underlying issues. So if you stop taking the medicine, the problem comes back because it hasn't really been dealt with. One of the nice things about the whole sort of behavior modification approach here was it was based on, in this sense, much like what Watson was advocating, it was based on issues of observable behavior. Whereas, say, a Freudian or a Jungian would want to get to the root causes of your behavior, possibly doing some hypnosis or some talk about early family experiences or whatnot, the behavior analyst didn't really care terribly much whether or not you'd seen your parents naked when you were young. It didn't matter. If you wanted to quit smoking, it didn't matter if you were stuck in an oral phase. If you wanted to quit smoking, you'd set up a situation where you were reinforced, the patient was reinforced for not smoking and would be punished for smoking. So you might start simply with, if how baseline, how many cigarettes do you smoke a day? 40. Okay. So let's see, that's an average of ... per an hour. Let's start with this. If you can, if it's like I'm smoking, 6 cigarettes an hour. Okay, so let's start with, if you can just reduce to 5 an hour, then you can, at the end of the day, reward yourself with whatever it is. Find something that is going to be reinforcing. And if you do smoke 6 an hour, then you have to take out a $10 bill and set it on fire and use that to light your 6th cigarette. Okay. And then after a while, it's like, okay, so let's take it from 5 down to 4. Don't you want to know why I smoke? Don't really care. Actually, not all that important to me now. Because of my parents, when I was young, don't care. Doesn't matter. Probably doesn't. Right? We just want to deal with the behavior right now. But I think I'm cool when I smoke. Okay. You're not, but let's just work with the reinforcement. A lot of people can't even articulate why they do this. There's not a lot of value in asking people, why are you doing this? When they go, I don't know. Well, we obviously have to get to the root of that. You can spend weeks and months in therapy, and the patient's going, I don't know. Never thought about it. I don't know. I'm not sure. This is annoying me. Okay? We're making real progress. Really? Are you sure? Okay. The other nice thing with these behavior modification techniques is you can teach the patient to do them themselves, right? It's not rocket science here. You can set, and matter of fact, good contingencies are set up such that the patient can then self-behavior modify. You don't always have to go running back to the therapist. But we don't see this used as often anymore because it is more time intensive You have to have a therapist working with the patient as opposed to in large groups or the use of drugs. This is still one of the primary techniques that's used with autistic kids. There's a lot of behavior modification therapy this way, so a lot of one-on-one interaction with kids. Now, we talked about tolerance a little earlier here in terms of punishment, and it's worth coming back to it at this point, because in terms of dealing with issues of punishment and behavior modification. It says actually something positive about people, is that people are generally unwilling, most people are generally unwilling to utilize strong punishers when trying to change a non-human animal or a person's behavior. I mean, if we were all just completely sadistic bastards, this would be no problem. We start with these really aversive outcomes. But we don't. Most people don't like making somebody else experience pain, be it your pet, be it your kid, be it your friend. Right? So I guess that's actually something nice about humans, positive thing about humans. The problem with that is it means that generally punishers are not as effective as they could be, because people don't tend to use them right. And so if you use punishment incorrectly, this can create a whole series of other issues, new behavioral problems that you then have to deal with, or it can actually exacerbate difficulties with the punishment situation itself, the use of an aversive. B.F. Skinner, right, like one of the founding people of the behavior analysis approach to therapy, said, look, I advocate that therapists use reinforcement techniques. He said, I can change any behavior by using appetitive outcomes. It just may take time. So that being said, if you don't have a lot of time, then yes, you should use an aversive. You should use a punisher. But you better be sure you know what you're doing. And this is really the issue. Are you sure you really know what you're doing? Most people don't. Right? I mean, even to the simple thing with my friend's Havanese dog. It's a bad dog. I don't understand, you know. I gave him a swat on his bum, and he keeps doing it. Yeah, because that's not an effective punisher. All you're doing is producing tolerance, right? In the dog's little brain, it's like, I did it and got away with it. I'm going to do it again. The worst that happens is I get a light smack. I'm fluffy. I barely felt that. I've gotten scraped up worse by the neighbor's cat. I rule this house. Okay? So, these become issues. So, this is why Skinner advocated use reinforcement instead. Unless this is something that's really time-critical. If you have a child that's engaging in, or adult that's engaging in, say, self-injurious behavior. We'll talk about some of these later in the course. Hitting themselves so hard that they're fracturing bones. You may not have the long time course. You know, you may not have weeks or even days to reduce this behavior through reinforcing other things. In which case, an appropriate use of punishment of an aversive. Can be very, very effective. But here's the thing. As I said with tolerance, you need to start with a strong punisher. It needs to be aversive enough to really reduce that behavior from the get-go. If it's not, you will develop tolerance. Think of the way, you know, we do this with kids. So hypothetical kid shoplifts a pack of gum from the drugstore, gets caught. I mean, what happens? Like, parents are like, you march right, you know, we're going to go in, you're going to apologize to the owner of the store. Okay. Gee. Right? Does it again. It's like, you're going to apologize and, you know, pay him equal value for the pack of gum. Give the gum back, apologize, and it's like, okay, yay, what's that, like a buck? What does gum cost? 79 cents? Whatever. $5? I don't know. Inflation. I'm not sure. I don't pay attention to gum. Right? Still, this is not a big deal, right? And so it's like, oh, I get caught sometimes, you know, and with Thor's I have to, sorry, you know. So the kid escalates. He's no longer stealing gum. He's, I don't know, stealing bottles of Tylenol. Works, how dare you steal Tylenol? I'm very disappointed in you. He's like, yeah. Works his way up to stealing bikes, cars, you know, diamonds, whatever it happens to be. Yeah, at some point, it's like, you know, gets into the penal system, so he gets put in juvie for a while. Okay. But what's been happening this whole time? Tolerance has been building up. By the time the kid's now into adult, and they face adult court, it's like, eh. You know, done so much juvie time and whatnot. It's like, this is nothing. Go ahead, bring it. You know, the big house? Bleh. I'll show you what the big house is. Okay? So we need a more aversive punisher right at the beginning. When kids shoplift gum, we need to cut their hands off. Wait, no, you see, there's the problem, right? Too aversive. And this is what Skinner was talking about. He said, this is the problem with it. Okay, you need to find something that is aversive enough, but not so aversive that, you know, it's crazy aversive. And you get into that problem. I don't know, take their cell phone away. Whatever. Parents have to do something, but it has to be something that's actually aversive. Okay? That's a start early. You start that early. Right? The beauty of this is if you actually start by punishing, if you're going to use punishment, and we'll talk about things like timeouts, so a negative punishment contingency, you set that up with your kids early, like when they're like, you know, a year old sort of thing. You know, no hitting. Instead of just like saying, no hitting. It's like, no hitting. Sit on the step. 30 seconds. Okay. Back in the game. 30 seconds is like a really long time for a young kid. Okay. It's not doing any real permanent damage to them. But you start that early. I mean, it's pretty aversive for a kid that big. At that point, you can you know, as they scale up in size, you can scale down, right? You don't have to keep incrementing the aversiveness up. So, anyways, there are some issues with implementing punishment. There's also possible consequences that can occur. Escape. So the subject, the patient, the person may be trying to escape, and they know something aversive is going to be coming, so they'll try to. Or something aversive is being delivered, so they'll try to escape right then, take off, or possibly avoid entirely. We can get into issues of aggression and violence if we're using physical forms of aversive punishers. Lots of studies show are more likely to lead to aggressive and violent responses, either at the person who's delivering the punishment, at the maybe self-directed violence or aggressiveness, or maybe directed towards others. Numerous studies demonstrate that children that observe acts of violence in their home are more likely to perpetuate acts of violence, say, on their own children when they have them. You can get into issues of apathy. This is a general suppression of other behaviors. So not the behavior they've been punished for, but this may spread. We'll talk about this in a while. It's called, if it gets really bad, it's called learned helplessness or just depression in humans. You could have instances of abuse where you have permanent damage, either physical or psychological, from the use of punishment. And as it related to the aggression and violence, imitation. Now, this may actually be the use of. It may be quite seemingly non-problematic. Okay, I've got kids, and three kids, and three dogs, and the one cat. The fish, but the fish don't count because they're simple. But, you know, periodically use various, you know, punishers with the dogs or sometimes a child, a timeout or something like that. The dogs get put on tie down, locked down and whatnot. So they have a little timeout themselves and whatnot. And, you know, the kids will try to imitate this because they see the grown-up do it. Then they'll do it. Now, it's not usually anything terribly devastating, but it's like, they don't get it. It's like, from their point of view, the things that should lead to the dog being locked up for a while are not necessarily the things that, that I, as an adult, think really need to be dealt with. Okay? So, you know, you do get that issue of imitation that can come in. And because the kids maybe just don't quite understand the situation from the perspective of, you know, age and maturity. And I'd like to say wisdom, but I don't entirely believe that I'm all that wise, really. I don't have the beard for it, I don't think. But they might end up imitating, you know, and that could transfer. It's like, all right, you know, if they think the youngest of the children, Kestrel, who's just about two, did something wrong, you know, I can visualize them trying to, like, tie him up with the, you know, sit next to the dogs and put on lockdown for, Kestrel knocked my model over, ooh, tie down. All right, don't put the baby on tie down, okay? Well, but you do it, not with the baby. Oh, yeah, with the dogs, yeah. Isn't that the same? No, yeah. Kids are funny. So what can we do? What can we do instead? Well, there's a variety of alternatives we can use in place of punishment. The first one, response prevention. Simply make it impossible for the individual to do the punishable behavior. Make it so they can't do the thing you don't want them to do. If you've got kids that are sneaking, you know, sneaking cookies, get rid of the cookies. You might just say, well, I'm just going to put the cookies up higher. You know, they can get them from the cupboard, but I'll put them way up high. Okay, that might work, but at some point the kids are going to figure out how to stack chairs and, like, teeter their way up there to try to get to the jar of cookies way up high, which could have all kinds of other problems. So circumvention can be an issue with response prevention. Response prevention works well with, like, younger children and non-humans, sort of, because they may not be able to figure a way around it. It's like, all right, you're eating too many cookies. I've taken the cookies away. Well, I have a job. I'm going to go buy my own damn cookies. Right, yes. Didn't think of that. I've bought all the cookies in the city and set them on fire. Okay, did you buy all the flour in the city? No. And the sugar? No. I'm going to make my own cookies. Damn. Your cognitive structure and your ability to find ways out of... So this tends to work nicely with younger kids and, like, you know, animals, non-human animals, all right? If you never, like, for example, I've been told by people... I'm not a horse person. The two things I'm most allergic to in the world were cats and horses. My wife's great aspiration in life would be to have a pony and kitten ranch. Should just kill me, which actually may be a subsequent benefit to the process. Anyways, from her point of view, I hope not. But I've been told by people that are into horses that if horses never actually see either another horse or a person jump a fence, they don't seem to understand that they can jump a fence. If they've always grown up with, like, even fences that are low enough that they could leap over it, but if they never see anyone else go over it, it's a bit of an observational learning process here, they just figure, I can't get over that. So there's these things called stiles, S-T-I-L-E. It's a little sort of bridge, like a little ladder bridge farmhands, you just, like, leap over the fence or climb over it. Instead, they walk up these little steps and then walk down the other side. And the idea is if horses see someone, because sometimes you just have to get over a fence if you're working on a farm, but the horse, like, comes up and is like, my hoofs won't quite work on these steps. Oh, I guess I can't get over the fence. Okay, so, you know, response prevention can work in the non-humans as well here. But not ideal for adults, right? You know, this is not the most ideal way to stop somebody smoking. I took and hid your cigarettes. I'm going to go buy more of them. It's like, yeah, unless they're really isolated out in the middle of, say, I don't know, the wilderness, it's like, fine, I'm going to burn leaves and stick them in my mouth. It's like, okay, great. Have other consequences. Extinction. We've talked about extinction. You can simply put your individual onto extinction. Now, this isn't always as easy as it seems. You've first got to identify what's actually the reinforcer for the behavior. Right, we talked about that. It, you know, it's like, somebody misbehaves, you send them to the principal's office in the classroom, and they keep doing it. It's like, okay, so there's something else going on here, whatever it is. Somebody's cheating on an exam, and they keep doing the, you know, why? What's going on? They're embezzling from work. You know, why? What's going on? If you can't address the reinforcer issue itself, extinction's not going to be effective. You just can't wait for it to stop. But it does involve, once you've done that, once you identify what the issue is, withhold the reinforcer. Problems? Well, first, figuring out what the reinforcer is. Second, extinction bursts. Third, it can be slow. All right? If you've got, say, a dog that, you know, your five-year-old dog that, you know, has been begging at the table for table scraps for years, and you say, finally, this is, you know, the vet says, your dog's getting fat, it's unhealthy, this is bad, you have to stop feeding them the dog table scraps, says, just stop doing it. It's like, okay. Well, first off, your dog's going to give you an extinction burst. If you thought the dog sitting there before was looking at you pitifully was bad, what happens when it starts sitting there looking at you pitifully? Well, and then when you still don't give it any food, it starts barking at you. And then it starts growling at you. It's starting to get unpleasant. Right? And it's just going to get worse before it gets better, and it's going to take a long time. The longer a behavior has been reinforced, the longer it is going to take to extinguish. So if you're going to use extinction, preferably this would be done with behaviors that have not been in play for very long, all right? But it can work. Here's some others. Differential reinforcement. There's a whole series of them, okay? So differential reinforcement of low responses, abbreviated DRL. In this case here, only reinforce a behavior when the responses occur at a low frequency. Okay, so you're not withholding all reinforcers. It's like, all right, with the cigarettes. Right? It's like, okay, you're smoking six an hour? All right, we're not going to reinforce you if you smoke six an hour. If you smoke five, just five, you've reduced it a bit, we'll give you a reinforcer. Okay, and then we can take this down, right? Okay, now we're only going to reinforce if you only smoke four in the hour. Three, two. You may not be able to completely take this down to zero, right? But you may be able to get it from six down to like two, or maybe one in an hour, maybe less. Combine it with other things. But the idea is you're only going to provide the reinforcement if you're still doing this behavior, but you're doing it at a lower rate, okay? Differential reinforcement of zero responses. This one says you will receive, at the end of some time period, whatever the time period is, you will receive reinforcement if you do not do the undesired behavior at all during that period of time. So if dinner takes, on average for you, 20 minutes, and you've got a dog that's frequently begging, say, all right. If the dog doesn't beg for the first 5 minutes, give him a little something. If he can go another 5 minutes without begging, it's like, okay, come here, here's a little snack, and so on. Then, after a while, you may say, okay, good, we've got that established, you know, now, but if it does beg during that 5 minutes, like, oh, sorry, nothing for this 5 minutes of dinner, you may take it up to 10 minutes. Okay, so now you have to, you know, no begging for 10 minutes. If you don't beg at all during the 10 minutes, again, you may not be able to completely eliminate the behavior, but it may be, okay, don't beg during dinner. If you don't beg at all during dinner, at the end, there's a little something, as opposed to constantly going from person to person to person at the table and getting little tidbits. But, yeah?
What happens when you get to the lowest possible rate, you don't stop?
Sorry, when you get to which?
To the lowest possible rate.
Yeah, what happens when you get to the lowest possible rate? You can just keep using that low rate, so you can just maintain it. It's like, okay, that's as low as we can get. We'll just keep operating on this on this schedule, this contingency. So you can keep doing it that way. You can just keep it in effect forever. Yeah. I mean, I'm not saying these are all different ways of dealing with it, and they're going to depend on what the situation is. Can you live with giving your dog a little bit of something at the very end of meal if it's not bothering you all during the meal? Maybe. Can your vet get behind that? Maybe. You know, for other things, it's like, okay, you know, for the psychopath, okay, we're only going to give you some reinforcement if you don't kill someone in this 1 week period. All right. Oops. No, in some cases, these aren't going to work, right? It's going to be depending upon, you know, the particular situation. Okay, so you have to tailor these. But the difference here is DRLs, low frequency, you're still performing the behavior, but at a lower frequency, lower rate. DR0s, no performance of the behavior during a set time period. It may be no texting during class. Then on the break, you go text as much as you want. Okay, so there's a period in there during which you're not doing the behavior. Now everyone's thinking, I wish I was texting right now. Differential reinforcement of alternative behavior, DRA. So you've got some undesired behavior that the individual's been doing, and they receive some form of reinforcement. This is what's prime the motivation. So identify what that reinforcement is, figure out what the motivator is. Now provide that when the individual does something else, some other behavior which you don't have a problem with. Okay? So if the subject needs to get, somebody is misbehaving to get attention, give them attention when they do something appropriate. Right? Make sure, and it may be somewhat annoying for you, right? Let's go back to like parents with kids, okay? You know, parents are busy, they're doing all kinds of other stuff, and the kid comes up and says, can you read to me? And it's like, not now. So then they douse the couch in gasoline and set it on fire. Suddenly they get attention. Okay, extreme case. Right? If you're doing something, even if the parent is busy, can you read to me? Yes. Give them the attention. Or put a placeholder in. Yes, can you give me 1 minute to finish what I'm doing? You can even watch me do it. Make sure I don't go away. Just let me finish this 1 minute, and then I will come read to you. Okay. So if they can get the in this case, example, the attention for doing something else, asking nicely, will you please come read to me? Give it. It might be disrupting your day a bit, but would you rather have them setting couches on fire or pulling the cat's tail or doing whatever? Turning into somebody like B.F. Skinner, making pneumatic catapults and shooting sandbags through the neighborhood. Down that path leads madness. Okay, so, yeah, it might be disruptive for you, but you've got to provide that reinforcement for these acceptable alternative behaviors. This is, again, why a lot of people wish there's just a pill that you could give for things, right? Because then it's like, yeah, no, I can't take this pill. So this is the thing with behavior modification. It does involve an investment by whoever the person is who is implementing the behavior. Differential reinforcement of incompatible behavior, DRI. it's sort of a subset of DRA. In the case of DRA, you're providing reinforcement for some alternatively acceptable behavior. In DRI, you are providing some type of reinforcement for a behavior that is completely incompatible with the undesired behavior. If you are doing this incompatible behavior, if you're doing this other behavior for which you will get reinforcement, you cannot possibly be doing the undesired behavior. They are literally incompatible. If you've got a kid who is, I don't know, drawing on the walls. It was driving you nuts. You know, give them a toy they want that they can play with outside. If they're playing outside, they can't be drawing on the walls inside. That's an incompatible behavior. Okay? So subset, I mean, it's an alternative behavior as well. So this is what I mean. The DRI is sort of a subset of your DRA, but it's not like, okay, you're drawing on the walls, here's a book to read. Well, you could be drawing on the book or drawing on the walls while looking at the book or taking a break from the book to draw on the wall. So it's alternative, but it's not incompatible in that case. So DRI, get something that's reinforcing, but to do that behavior, you cannot do the undesired behavior. They are separate. Non-contingent reinforcement. We've talked about contingencies before. So why, if and only if X, so this event will occur if and only if this other event occurs. In non-contingent reinforcement, then, what you're essentially doing is you're just providing reinforcement randomly. So if you've got an individual that is engaging in an undesired behavior because this provides some form of reinforcement, one, identify what that reinforcement is, or at least identify something that will be reinforcing for the individual, preferably the reinforcement that they're getting from the undesired behavior, and then just periodically give them that reinforcement, regardless of what they're doing. You're trying to break the contingency. If it's like, oh, I get attention by dipping Susie's pigtails in the inkwell. Nobody uses ink anymore, do they? That's a bad example, but you probably get the concept, you know. I get attention by dropping, you know, putting a computer virus onto Susie's iPad that makes it say, Susie, you stink, whatever it is. Okay, if he gets attention that way, just give attention at just random times. The idea here is, oh, look, you get the reinforcer without having to do anything. You're getting this for, what's the word? Oh, yeah, free. You can either do something which may be reinforcing to you, may provide some motivation, some satisfaction, but there will be an aversive consequence, or you can get that reinforcement without having to do anything at all. Humans and other non-humans have evolved to be lazy. This is not a bad thing. It's called energy conservation, right? You find a few people that don't kind of get this, but it's like, here, I'm going to give you this thing. What do I have to do? Absolutely nothing at all. I don't trust you. No, really, it's fine. Here it is. Okay, thank you. You still find a few people go, no, I'm not taking it. But most people, it's like, I have to do really nothing for it? Yes. Is it a pyramid scheme? No. Do I have to sign up for something? No. Will you contact me again? No. I don't understand. Look, do you want this or not? Okay. There you go. If you can get it for free, why pay for it? The thing is, there can't actually be a catch, right? To use non-contingent reinforcement to reduce a behavior, you can't have that hook. All we want is for you to come to this one seminar that talks about our timeshare. No, you can't put a hook in there. Non-contingent reinforcement used in a therapeutic way to change a behavior, it just has to be something for nothing. Kind of like the old Dire Straits song. Okay? So, no correlation between the response and the outcome. You get the outcome regardless of what's happening. This is not always an ideal situation. You may have it because if you're just providing this reinforcement at random points, if it's really just sort of random, there's no contingency, you may have an individual who's doing a whole series of undesired things, which means just randomly you may end up having, they do some undesired behavior and randomly it's like, hey, here's the reinforcement. You don't want it to be, you know, you don't get the reinforcement because it did the undesired thing, but if it comes right after it, think of contiguity. right? Those things close together in time, and boom, you may just inadvertently have reinforced some other undesired behavior, okay? So again, one has to think a little bit about whether or not this is an appropriate way to change a behavior. But if you've got someone who's, you know, an individual who's only very occasionally doing this undesired behavior, then, yeah, this could be great. Periodically provide, just randomly provide reinforcement. It's like, oh, you know, I don't have to do something bad to get this thing that I want. Okay. Negative punishment. So, when I described this, one of our little charts, and, you know, imagine there's two levers, and you press the one lever, and the trap door opens, and the food gets destroyed, that sort of thing. So something's taken away, and the behavior decreases. The more typical way that we see, you know, I mean, it's kind of an odd little example I gave you, but it worked in the context of rats and levers and food. But more typically, we see negative punishment being applied in conditioning situations, behavior modification situations, as the removal of a pleasant stimulus. So something is taken away, so you take something pleasant away, and behavior decreases. This is a punisher, right? I mean, the idea of punishment is something goes down. But it's not due to the delivery of an aversive. Okay, so it's not like, you do this, I'll hit you with a stick. It's like, oh, you hit somebody with your favorite stick, I'm going to take your stick away from you. Some people are going, eh? Boys probably get this more. Anyone that's around boys, you know, they'll find sticks. It's a male thing. If you've got a stick, you should hit something with it. Most boys and some girls, it's like, I've got a stick. What do I do with it? It can be a Harry Potter wand for a while, or it can be a sword or a gun, or it can just be a stick that I hit things with. It's a kid thing, okay? So, you know, I'm not going to hit you with your stick. I'm going to take your stick away for a while. Will I get it back? Mm-hmm. In a while. When? When I give it back to you. When's that going to be? When I say it is. So how long? It's going to be longer and longer the more you keep talking to me. Oh. Timeout. Well, it's a little bit different. I mean, the stick gets a timeout in this case here, right? So you remove something desired. There you go. If this results in a decrease in behavior, yay! Negative punishment. Okay? You can remind them. Oh, are you going to be hitting somebody with that stick? Remember what happened the last time? You know, you hit somebody with that stick? You took the stick away from me. Yeah. How do you think the stick felt? Sticks don't feel anything. Exactly. How did you feel? Not really happy. Okay. If it's a really young kid, it's like, how do you think the stick felt? The stick was sad. It missed you. Okay. Works with really young kids. A little bit later, it's like, Dad, sticks don't feel anything. It's just a piece of wood that's been separated from the tree, so it's no longer getting electrolytes and sap and stuff. It's dead. It's just cells. Yeah. Okay, anyways, you're too old for me to use that anymore on you. You have to modify these as you go, okay? Tell your parents. You'll figure it out. Yeah, I think university is a tough learning curve. Try having kids. Timeout is the other sort of time-honored approach to this. So, you know, doing something wrong. It's like the penalty box, right? Okay, Canadians, right? Hockey. Okay, even if you don't particularly watch hockey, people get hockey, okay? You do something wrong, boom, off to the penalty box. It's a timeout. You don't get to play for, you know, 2 minutes, 5 minutes, right? If you've done something really bad, it's a game misconduct. You're yanked for one or more games. Okay? So it's not like, you know, you play hockey. I mean, basically you play hockey professionally or even at an amateur level. You know, the idea of being hit by something is just part of the game. So it's not like, you know, you're going to take a hockey player, ooh, you did a high sticking. We'll now beat you with something. It's like, that's the game, right? Unfortunate, but that's the way it is. And because you high-sticked, we'll have three other people from the other team cross-check you. It's like, yeah, it happens anyway. No, it's like, you don't get to play for a while. Ooh. Your team's at a disadvantage. How do you like them apples? Time out. Okay. Something is taken away. Hopefully the behavior goes down. Does it not? Okay. Very, very popular in human behavior modification. This can work in things like dog training or whatnot. Has to be done pretty much right away. Dogs have really short memories for things. If it's more than about 30 seconds or maybe a minute, it's just like, what happened? They don't remember. So if you're going to like do some sort of timeout, you've got to basically catch them doing whatever it is and implement it more or less right away. Yeah?
If it doesn't produce the behavior, is it still a negative punishment?
No, if it doesn't... That's actually an excellent question. If it doesn't reduce the behavior, we can at least say it's not a punisher. If it's increasing a behavior, then it's some sort of reinforcer. Okay. If the behavior is just staying at the same level, then it's basically what we've tried to implement is just having no effect. There's probably something else that's maintaining the behavior in there. If you do this and the behavior actually increases, then it's like, yay, you've reinforced it somehow. You suck. Oops. Yeah. So, no, it's going to be a negative punishment if the behavior actually goes down. So these are sort of idealized situations. If you try it and it's not working, stop doing it. Okay. I mean, don't just try it once, right? You may need to try this a few times, sort of thing. But if, you know, after a reasonable number of applications, your technique is not working, you'll have to modify, try something else. It may be that what you've removed is not salient enough for them. It's like, generally, I generally despise Dr. Phil. I have a deep-seated loathing of the man in the show, not because he makes more money than I am, but because I think he does horrible things to the field of psychology. However, you know, very occasionally, I think he's not completely incompetent or a bit of a douchebag. He's been barred from practicing. He actually legally cannot practice psychology. So that's why if you ever watch the show, he never says, I will work with you. It's like, we will hook you up with somebody else that will work with you, because he can't. He can't practice. He's been disbarred. But at one point, you know, it's some celebrity on, I can't remember who it was, and it was like, Dr. Phil, you know, I've tried the stuff you've said with the kids, I've tried the timeout, and it just doesn't work. It's like, okay, where are you sending the kid for his timeout? Well, I send him to his room. And what does he have in his room? His toys and his books and his personal phone and his computer with internet and his Wii and his PlayStation and his Xbox. It's like, oh, I get it. It's like, yeah, sending the kid to the room. It's just like, I really wish, you know, you have to take part in family activities. Can't I just go to my room and play with my Xbox? No, you're going to take part in family activities. Dad, he threw his fork at me. That's it, go to your room. Okay, if you insist. If you're going to do a timeout, you know, you gotta do it where there's nothing more entertaining in the timeout zone, right? The chair facing the wall, the stairs going down to the basement, you know, there's nothing else they can really do. You don't have to make the timeout very long, you know, 30 seconds, minute, couple minutes. Then bring them back in. Other techniques. Overcorrection. In overcorrection, you have to repeat the desired behavior. So, child slams door to room, blah, 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 hate you, blah, 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 slam. You know you're not supposed to slam the door. You have to shut the door perfectly quietly 25 times. Do it. 1, 2, 3, click. I heard that, start over. 1, 2. The beauty of this is, parenting trick, they're getting close to 25 and you want them to keep going. 23. I heard that. Oh, you did it. Parental ears. You can't do that too often, but, you know. So it's like, you're doing it the right way, and you have to do it a whole bunch, and it's annoying. Now, I guess you'd say that's, if it works, it's a positive punishment. Something is being delivered, you're being forced to close the door a whole bunch of times. But it's not like you're, you know, beating them with a stick or verbally abusing them. You're incompetent, you can't actually close a door quietly. I've seen, I don't know, elephants that could do this better than you. That's kind of abusive, right? There's nothing that's really going to, if anything else, they're going to get good, you know, wrist musculature. You're turning the doorknob and closing the door. Okay. Restitution is another one, right? Principle of restitution. You know, you do something to somebody else, you have to pay. You have to give something of yours up, right? Kid one takes kid two's toy. You not only have to, kid one not only has to give kid two back the toy that was taken, but also give up one of his or her own toys. You have to make restitution. Now, maybe that's a permanent giving up of toy. Maybe it's a temporary giving up of toy. Positive practice, similar to the overcorrection. You not only have to, you know, behave well. You have to apologize, for example, nicely. Tough for kids, right? Okay, but they learn the appropriate behavior, and they really don't want to do it, especially to someone who they've just, you know, wronged. Okay. So technically, these are punishers, right? Assuming it works, are technically generally positive punishers. But we're not in the same category of hooking the individual up to a car battery and giving them a shock. Right. Stimulus satiation is another way go after this. Old Donald Duck cartoon demonstrated this quite nicely. So yeah, Donald Duck, and he's got his nephews, Huey, Dewey, and Louie. And for some reason, Huey, Dewey, and Louie decide that this is an old cartoon, right? Because you don't see this kind of stuff anymore. They're going to get Uncle Donald a cigar for his birthday, because he's such a great uncle. I don't know how they figure he's a great uncle, but still. You also don't see Disney, like, you know, having nephews buy their uncle's cigars anymore, because that's just not right. So they're going to get him the cigar and whatnot, and Donald sees them in their little clubhouse with a cigar, and he's horrified because it's okay for him to smoke cigars, but if the kids are doing it, that's bad. And so, using the incredible reasoning that Donald has, he goes out and grabs his box of cigars and starts forcing his nephews to chain smoke them until they're horribly ill and vomiting and turning green and that sort of thing. So stimulus satiation. So I'm going to fix your smoking by making you smoke until you are violently ill. Right. Cartoon. But that's the idea. Here's a classic example, therapeutic example. There was a woman in a hospital who was a bit of a, well, nowadays we call her a hoarder. Okay, terms become popularized. Her thing was towels. So she's been hospitalized for this obsessive compulsive disorder and towels. She was always asking the nursing staff for towels. Please, could I have some more towels? You've already got four sets of towels in your room. You really don't. I really need some more towels. And this is pretty annoying for the nursing staff. It was disrupting things. And if they didn't bring her more towels, she'd like sneak out of her room and go into the other patients' rooms and steal their towels and like start hiding in the room. And then the nursing staff would go in, bring, you know, it's like, I don't have any towels. You had towels. I brought you towels. Like, oh, you know, this is Sorry Nikki or whatever her name was, you know, took the towels. Okay. So I said, okay, fine. Let's try this. Let's try this instead. Let's try a stimulus satiation process. Take her towels. So they brought in a truckload of towels. And just what happened was the nursing staff would just periodically show up and was like, oh, I found some more towels. I know you love towels. I've brought you more towels. So, thank you very much. And put them down. And, you know, she'd still be sneaking out to grab other towels and steal other people's towels. And the nursing staff just keeps coming in with towels in the course of a couple of days, bringing more and more and more towels until, like, the room is just being filled with towels, like literally stuffed with towels. The room was like, looking over a pile of towels. And it's like, we found you some more towels. And at some point, it's like, I think maybe I don't need any more. No, we know you love towels. We'll just throw them in. Start pitching them in. At which point, something interesting happens. She starts actually squirming her way out and now starts taking towels into other patients' rooms and leaving them there. And the psychologist says, okay, slow down, just stop taking her more towels. Okay, slow this down, let's see where this goes. And what happened was they got down to the point where she always wanted to have more towels than she really needed, but as long as she was at that level, she was good. Okay, so they satiated her desire for towels, brought it under control. So there's another technique there. Let's take a 10-minute break.